Hi, everyone. This is Gail. Before we get started, I have a pretty big announcement. I am so proud to share that She Explores is going to be released as a full-color book in late March and is available for pre-sale now. The book features first-person profiles on 40 women, some who've been featured on this show, like Julie Hotz, Teresa Baker, Simone Martin Newberry, the musical Mountaineers, and Karen Wang, to name a few. The book is a celebration of all the different ways we experience the outdoors, and I can't wait to share it with you. Learn more and pre-order a copy via she-explores.com/book, linked in our show notes. Okay, enough self-promotion. On with the show. I'm really excited to be back and sharing stories in 2019. I'm Gail Straub, and you're listening to She Explores. A river runs through the New Hampshire town I call home, and I often walk down to it when I'm in need of fresh air. I've always loved how reactive it is to rain and changes in temperature, but if I'm honest, I haven't thought about it too much. Rivers pass through all the old mill towns in New Hampshire and New England. Most mills are no longer in use. Before I read Heather Hansman's upcoming book, Downriver, I hadn't thought about all the quiet ways a river benefits communities, industries, and wildlife. And I certainly hadn't thought about how delicately balanced the uses of a river have to be in order for all the people and animals using it to be sustained. Heather Hansman spent her college summers as a rafting guide on a 12-mile stretch of the Kennebec River in Maine. She was 18 that first summer and had no idea what to expect. She'd taken the job on a whim.
I didn't have a car at the time. It was like pre-cell phone. My mom dropped me off, drove me up to like the middle of nowhere in northern Maine, dropped me off in the parking lot with like my little sleeping bag and my backpack and my life jacket. And then it's basically like enforced hazing. Like they make you go and run the river as many times as you can every day that week. And it's, you know, May in northern Maine, so it's freezing. And you're carrying boats around and like learning how to do all these weird things. And you have to flip rafts and practice swimming through rapids and that kind of thing. So it's like a little bit of, you know, torture to see who can be the toughest. But I totally loved it, even though it was miserable.
You must have been pretty sore after that week.
Yeah, sore. And just like it was so cold in the morning that our wetsuits would freeze overnight. It was just this kind of like, I feel like sometimes things like that are, the crappy parts are like kind of the glory. It's like it's type two fun.
Yeah.
And you kind of get out the other end and you're like, yeah, I'm tough enough that I can do that. That first summer, I remember being really sort of like cocky and just being like, oh, I'm great at this. And then I had a couple flips in boats and got pinned underwater for a little bit. And I had a bad kayaking accident. And I just like got a little less, I got put back in my place a little bit by river. So I think at that point, I wasn't quite as cocky as I had been. I don't know. I think that's like with anything, is you know, you get a little more experience and you cut down to size a little.
Heather gained a respect for the river and the lifestyle. After graduating from college, she moved out to Colorado to continue to guide. She'd grown up on the East Coast and was drawn to the stories of the West, the bigness of it all.
So reading river is basically like being able to look downstream and figure out where the rapids are and where you want to be and where you don't want to be, where big waves or holes are going to be and where eddies where you can potentially stop. I don't know. I was like looking at mountains and being like, where would you want to ski? And like looking at rivers and being like, where would you want to go?
It feels like it's like a combination of problem solving and intuition moving through that.
Yeah, I think that's like exactly what that is. Yeah, it's like you can kind of figure it out, but you also kind of have to like let it happen or like not fight it.
Time on the river had a hold on her. She guided full time for 3 summers, living in Vail and guiding on the Arkansas. She then moved to Denver and worked for the nonprofit City Wild, training kids how to be rafting guides. Even when she went to grad school, she continued guiding on and off part time.
So it took me a little while to, like, pull myself away from it.
Slowly, Heather began to feel more removed from her life on rivers and the issues facing rivers in the West. Her budding career as a journalist pulled her from Los Angeles to Seattle. She writes in the opening of Downriver, quote, "I stopped guiding. I moved to a city. And the less time I spent on the river, the more abstract it felt, even when I told myself I was paying attention. I'd felt a sense of ignorance creeping in, and it creeped me out. Nothing I read seemed to tell the whole story of how water is tied to people's lives and livelihoods and what they might stand to lose," unquote.
I get up in the morning and I take a shower and I don't think about how long that shower is that much. And I turn on the tap to make coffee. I think that's part of it. And part of why water is such like a tricky thing to try and think about in the future is that because we have these baked in systems where we don't really have to think about how much we're using day to day and where it comes from and where it might be going and why we get it, it's sort of easy to remove yourself from it. And even like in the past couple of years when California has been really dry and there have been water restrictions, I think there are some places in the world that are getting to a point where we do have to think about that. And there are even places in the US, like on, you know, reservations where water infrastructure is really poor. But in my day-to-day life, I don't necessarily have to think about it.
I ran a survey about this podcast in December, asking you what you were interested in hearing about this year. One of the most prevalent answers centered around conservation and what we as individuals can do to become more aware about issues and actively make a difference when so much is at risk. And yet, conservation is an abstract concept. Reading about issues of energy usage and preservation of public lands in the news can feel overwhelming, confusing, and hopeless. Sometimes it's easier to just scroll on by another article about the cumulative impact that we as human beings have on the world. Heather decided to spend about 2 months pack rafting the Green River, the chief tributary of the Colorado River, to learn about the water use issues facing it. She wrote a book about the experience. It's part adventure memoir, part investigative journalism, and it'll be out in March. I got to read an early copy in advance of our conversation.
It felt like this thing that was really important to me that I felt really disconnected from. And I wanted to tell that story. And then I think I also, on some level, was like antsy and like craving some kind of adventure. And this felt like something that I wasn't totally sure if I could do, but I was pretty sure that I could do. This is maybe not always the way that books come about, but I had sort of pitched the idea and, you know, this is an important thing to talk about. I'm gonna tell this story in this way. I'm gonna go paddle this river. And then I was like, oh shit, I have to go do this thing now that I said that I would do. But I think like on some base level, I just wanted that push and I wanted to see if I could do it. And I wanted to be back on the river. Like it felt like I'd become, I think on a lot of levels, like kind of become far away from this thing that felt really important to me.
Yeah. And you said that you started to feel anxious about water too, just or how you would handle yourself on the river.
Yeah. And I think I think it's like getting back on the horse in any level where like when you're doing something all the time, you feel really comfortable and you know how you're going to react. And then I had kind of like, I had this like sense of self-identity where I was like, I'm a river person. But then I was like, I'm not actually spending that much time in the water anymore. And I'd gotten sort of like more nervous, more worried about like, would I be able to deal with it if something went wrong? And this did sort of force me to like throw myself back into it. And I actually dislocated my shoulder 8 weeks before I left. And all of a sudden I was like, should I do this thing? Like, is this a really stupid idea? Am I throwing myself into this like dumb adventure that I made up just because I'm stubborn and just for the sake of it? And like maybe worked out, but yeah, I don't know. I think I don't have a great, like I needed to go, or like there's not sort of like a big epic backstory to it, but I think that's maybe part of it. Like I wanted to go because I wanted to go.
It seems like you kind of slowly gained clarity around it, too, as you kind of went down the river, as you're thinking about what an adventure means to you and what it means to write an adventure memoir that's grounded in this conservation story and also, you know, how you feel about the way water's being used and what you're learning from other people as you kind of make your way down the river.
Yeah. In trying to write a book about this, I wanted to write something that was the kind of book that I would want to read. And I think the things that I connect with the most often have like a pretty strong narrative voice, and like where you feel like the main character is somebody, you know, that you're also like looking through their eyes. I think that's part of why it felt really important to me to not just tell this as like a journalistic reported story, kind of like actually be in it and see what it looked like.
And you also, at certain points, think about your role as a woman doing a solo adventure, too. And you do mention the fact that, like, women tend to be, you know, there aren't that many adventure memoirs that are written by women, for first off. And secondly, that they have tended to follow a certain narrative. And I've talked with Charlotte Austin and Shantae Salabert about, like, the kind of, like, wild effect in memoirs. The Cheryl Strayed, like, go into the wilderness to heal your wounds. And there's nothing wrong with that, but that's not, like, you mentioned that you don't necessarily want to follow that same narrative.
Totally. And it was actually interesting in pitching the book, how many people were like, oh, it's like a wild thing. And you're like, no. But I think and I love Cheryl Strayed's writing. And I think wild is like totally powerful for a lot of reasons and impacted people in a lot of ways. But that narrative of like women go to the wilderness because they're running away from something or trying to figure themselves out or chased or like there has to be some big catalyst, like, doesn't feel true to my experience. And, like, doesn't feel true to most of the women that I spend time with outside. Like, that, for us, I think is more, it's, like, a part of who we are and what we do and our communities than, like, this faraway point that you have to reach to learn some truth about yourself or something really deep or something like that. You know, part of the story is me having this adventure, and that's one of the nuts of the story, but I didn't want to necessarily make that a big deal. I wanted that to be, like, a strand of the story. I didn't want that to be the story.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely think you succeeded in that. It felt like, you know, knowing that you're a journalist, it felt like you were leading with curiosity going down the river, and I love that.
That is a really nice way of saying it. Thank you.
I also like the little nuggets about river life that I wouldn't know, having not been on a river rafting trip. Just, like, even little things, like, it was so hot that you just got, like, a beer to drink later and ice cream at the convenience store before heading back onto the river.
Man, it was so hot for some of it. Yeah. And it was like, I think that's kind of why I'm like wanted to be a raft guide initially and was like drawn to this, like, that those are the places where like I feel like the most myself, or I mean it sounds cheesy, but like those are the places that I think are the best. And it's like night, like I want to be able to write about that and try to explain that to the world and like not have it feel like some like desperate, brutal, faraway thing.
So Heather took her time rafting the river to better understand it. Often she was by herself, sometimes friends and family accompanied her. She met and interviewed the river stakeholders too. There were a lot of logistics involved.
I planned this trip, I said I was gonna do it, and then was like, oh man, how do I actually figure out how to get from point A to point B and get myself enough food, and like where can I get on and off the river, where are the access points, who do I talk to? And I luckily had people, like I said, my parents came for a little chunk, I've got buddies in different parts of the world who would come and move my car or come with me for a little bit. But that almost felt like the most intimidating part in the beginning, was like figuring out how long each chunk of the river trip would be, where I could park, where I could camp, what boat I was going to do it in. I ended up doing most of it in a pack raft, which is like a little one-person raft, basically. And the one that I have, you can stick a bunch of your gear inside the tubes. So it's like a pretty slick little system. I had kind of like committed to doing that. I got the boat. And then I called this guy who's paddled a bunch of stuff in northern Wyoming, and he was kind of like asking me about my logistics. He was like, you're doing it in a pack raft? That's stupid. He had done all of it in a canoe. He was like, you're gonna be so slow, it's gonna be terrible, it's gonna be brutal. So I was like second guessing myself and fighting it like the whole the whole lead up and trying to figure out how to do it.
It's always nice to have someone tell you that exactly what you're doing is
I'm
wrong.
Dumb, yeah. Like some guy you've never met who's just talking on the phone. Yeah.
And then also, like, you become so dependent on the river, too, that so if there isn't enough water, you can't really predict your speed necessarily.
Yeah, and a lot of it was I'd kind of set up, and there's a couple places where you need permits, so I had hard dates of where I needed to be. But I was sort of ballparking and guessing how long it was going to take me to do things. And luckily, in the beginning, I had pretty high flows. Like, I kind of timed the snow melt pretty well. So I wasn't fighting it too bad in the beginning. And the last, kind of in Canyonlands, the last couple of stretches, it got pretty draggy. The river got low. And we had a couple of really long days. I had three friends come with me for the last stretch, and we canoed down. And you get a shuttle back out to Moab, basically. After the point where we took out, you drop into Cataract Canyon, which is kind of class four, and we weren't going to do it in canoes. And we almost missed the pickup. We were, like, fighting to get down to it.
Oh, man.
All that stuff. Yeah, the food logistics, the trying to keep stuff cold.
Well, you even mentioned, like, having basically one outfit, too, and trying to keep out of the sun. I mean, you're just in the sun all the time.
Yeah, it's almost like staying cool is the hardest part. And especially there's a couple stretches between Vernal, Utah, where Dinosaur National Park is, and then you get into, like, Desolation and Gray Canyon, kind of into sort of more central Utah, and there's just nothing. There's no shade. You're kind of camping on these little sandbar islands, and it's just like there's no way to get out of it. Go sit in the water for as long as you can each day. You know, I'd spent a lot of time on the river, but for the most part on shorter trips where I just was going to, you know, like go home and change my clothes every day or like decide what I was going to bring each morning. And whenever anyone came along with me, they got really like amused by my food stash because I got really dirtbaggy about that. And I just eat like the same thing. I eat my like packet of oatmeal in the packet every morning and my like tortilla and string cheese and an apple at lunch every day. And, like my tasty bite every night. So you do, it's kind of nice in some ways because you do kind of, you know, you can carry a fair amount of stuff in a boat, but you don't really need to. So it's not maybe quite as minimalist as backpacking or something like that, but I felt like I kind of got my system down and I didn't need extra stuff.
Was it hard to have other people coming in then? So like when you had friends visit or your parents, like that kind of broke your system at times?
I almost got in a fight, like a pretty big fight with one of my good friends who came for the last section because I had, her family owns a coffee roaster. She's like a big coffee person. And I had like perfectly rationed out those little Starbucks Via packets. And one morning she like made two Via packets. And I was like, we don't have. Like, I was like, we, the numbers are off. So.
So you did say one thing in the book, and I think it was when you were kind of frustrated with the river, and you said that doing risky things on your own doesn't make you better or tougher. And I was wondering if that was a feeling that was like rooted in the moment or if it was like something that you took away from the experience.
Yeah, I think it's kind of both.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's like so easy to like glorify adventures. You'd be like, I'm going to go do this like cool hard thing on my own, and like a lot of times I was out there and I was like, why am I like, it's nicer when there's people around, like why did I decide I had to do this like whole big hard thing? So you don't need to go and paddle the whole thing to like feel connected to it and to understand it. You can go for 2 days and that still feels good and that's still important. I don't know, I think in a lot of adventure narratives too there is this like, we had to go out and we had to suffer and then we overcame this thing. And I don't think I think that's like a little bit oversimplified and like maybe not that interesting.
Is that what you're sometimes left with though? Like when you talk about type 2 fun and that making it an enriching experience. So like for the reader, sometimes vicariously living through that reading through that can make you get that feeling. But if it's repeated over and over again, then.
And I think also like I had sort of like a long, hard, lonely day and it was hot and I was cranky. Like that's not narratively that interesting. Especially in the kind of like go west young man, like that kind of narrative, I think it is the sort of like we're fighting out there on our own, like that gets glorified so much. And I don't think that, I don't know, I guess like that's not the only way to do it.
Yeah, and I actually interviewed a woman named Nicole Antoinette in December or November. Anyway, it was a couple episodes ago, and she mentioned that she feels like the solo women's narrative gets over romanticized too, in terms of both the learning about yourself, but also that that's like the way you got to do it in order to feel accomplished.
Yeah, totally. Oh, that's funny. I have to listen to that one. Like that. Yeah, I think it is. It becomes a sort of trope.
Mm-hmm.
And some of my best days on the river were like with like those friends who came at the end, brought good snacks, and we were singing, and it was goofy, and like we would like do water aerobics in the river at the end of the day, and like that was like way better than me just like grinding up by my own and sticking my butt in the river at the end of the day because I was hot and crabby.
It is interesting how you get used to both, though. So like it seemed like it would be hard when you emerged from the solo times or when you emerged from the times with friends.
Yeah, definitely. Like those I think it's like the transitions are always hard. Like you kind of get in your groove either way, but then where you're kind of like you come back to society and you like don't really know how to function, or people leave and all of a sudden it feels really, really lonely. A lot of times, especially in those longer stretches, it's so nice because you kind of get into a routine and you know exactly what your days are going to look like and you don't have to think about anything outside of like, okay, we're going to pack up camp and put on the river and we're going to go X amount of miles and then we're going to set up camp again. You can't live like that forever, but it is such a like kind of amazing cycle to be in.
We'll hear more from Heather after this. The beginning of the year is all about fresh starts, and New Year's resolutions are often about building healthy habits. But there's really no quick fix when it comes to better health. It's about starting daily habits and sticking with them over time. Ritual, the obsessively researched vitamin for women, is one way to build in a healthy habit. Two easy-to-take capsules provide 9 nutrients you need to build a stronger foundation for better health. I've been a Ritual Essentials subscriber since last summer. I appreciate that from D3 to omega-3s, the Ritual Essential for Women fills the gaps in my diet, especially this time of year when I'm lacking in sunlight. I also really like the minty flavor. It's not fishy like a lot of omega-3 pills. Because better health doesn't happen overnight, start your year with Essential for Women, a small step that helps create a healthy foundation for 2019 and beyond. Visit ritual.com/explore to start your ritual today. That's ritual.com/explore. We're back. So before I read Downriver, I didn't know a thing about water rights. And in truth, what should be simple is pretty darn tricky to explain. Its simplest meaning is a legal entitlement that authorizes water to be diverted from a source, like a river, and put to beneficial, non-wasteful use, like drinking water. When water is plentiful, it's not really something we think a lot about. But when water isn't plentiful, like with the Colorado River Basin, it starts to get competitive and complicated. In 1922, 7 states in the Colorado River Basin signed the Colorado River Compact because people were starting to fight about how water was being used. They estimated there was approximately 18 million acre-feet available, and they divvied it up. Heather points out in her book that this is problematic for many reasons, the biggest being that water is slippery, inherently variable.
They signed the compact in 1922, and that 10-year period before that was like one of the wettest periods in recorded history. So, of course. So what they thought, the amount of water they thought they had was totally higher than average to begin with. And then when they broke it up there's 2 basins along Colorado, and it's broken up by state, they basically already allocated more water than actually exists. And then, especially in the last 20 years, that whole area has been in drought. And we've gotten, I don't want to misspeak on the numbers here, but it's something like, 80% of average or something like coming into the basin. And then they're predicting that it could be, we'd only be getting 50% of average within the next 100 years.
Whoa.
Yeah. So it's like the numbers are, the projections, it's all modeling, but they are pretty scary. And so there's this problem of like, we already don't have enough to go around if everyone uses what they're legally allocated, and then there's going to be even less.
And it's kind of incentivized so that people or, you know, organizations or whoever is using it is supposed to use it, right? Like kind of prove that they're using it.
Yeah, exactly. If you don't use it, you lose it, basically. And so the way that water rights, and that was set up initially so that if there was unused water in the system, it could be sent somewhere else, which is, you know, somebody's idea of conservation. But that does incentivize water rights holders to use all their water, because if they don't, they could potentially lose it. And then if they did need it, it wouldn't be there. And that's something that's, I think that's a place where there's potential use change in the future, where people are talking about water markets and finding ways to sort of lease or sell water so that people don't feel scared to not use all their water. But a lot of it is like the system we have in place, which worked for when there weren't a lot of people around, doesn't work now.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I can't remember the figures exactly either, but the population is going up as well. So that's another thing impacting it, and the overall general warming of the West as well.
Yeah. The West is warming. People are moving to cities. Yeah. The way we do everything is changing.
Ugh. I mean, at times reading the book, it felt very complicated at times, like even us just trying to piece together everything. And I know you know it back and forth, but just it's a lot to take in. And it just feels like a very American thing to do, to have, you know, it's like the tax system, just like, let's make it at its core. It's supposed to be as simple as possible. But because we're, I don't know if it's just Americans, human beings, we just like keep adding to things, but we won't like break everything apart and just start again.
Well, I think that's so hard to do. Like you talk about, like, I feel like I keep like talking about politics now, but it's the same thing where it's like the system is pretty broken, but like we can't totally tear down the system because people depend on the system. So how do you then like try and change it within what we have working? And it is this like I've spent, you know, 4 years thinking about this, and I still definitely don't feel like I understand it in a lot of ways, because it is so complicated and so many people's different interests are involved. And it's like state law and federal law and local practices. And I wish I had come out of it with like some good, like, here's a solution, like, here's what we can do. I mean, obviously, that's like overly simplified anyway.
So while it's complicated, Heather wrote Downriver in an approachable way. As she pack raft down the Green River, she met and talked with people who are personally impacted by water rights. For me, it made it much more relatable. The book is broken up into sections to help tell the stories of use cases. I asked Heather why she did this.
In thinking about water and how people use it, that felt like the biggest question, or like the biggest framework to me, that there were these different sort of like discrete groups of people or users, and all their intentions were really different, and the way they thought about water was really different. And I wanted to kind of talk to them and get their take on it, and then also look at where like the conflicts between those groups were. Mm-hmm. And so the way I'd broken it out was ranchers and farmers, like agriculture use, which is kind of the oldest, most traditional water use, and the one that has those most senior water rights. And then I looked at city water users instead of like urban water. And then I looked at power and dams and energy generation, not even just water use, but like how we kind of control water. And then I looked at ecosystems and fish, which are big endangered native fish are like a big factor on that river, and sort of like how that sort of ecosystem service fits in. And then I looked at recreation, because that's kind of where my line comes in, and also sort of like how economies depend on the river in ways that aren't just necessarily for the river or just for the water. And then there was sort of this, like, those are all the like kind of discrete users now. And then I kind of wanted to look at what's potentially happening in the future too. So I looked at energy use, which is changing a lot in that river basin, and tribal water rights. Tribes have the oldest water rights in the river basins there, but they're the only water users that don't, when you have a senior water right, like one of the old ones, you have to put it to use to hold on to it. And because tribes are federally grandfathered in, they don't necessarily have to be using their water rights, and they can always put them into play. In theory, they can always put them into play whenever they want. But because by the time that happens, there might not be enough water to go around. That's sort of a big, sticky, political, ethical, you know, social justice problem that no one has really figured out how to deal with that's brewing right now. And then climate is sort of like the other big, what are we going to do? How is this going to impact, like, you know, use of, it's not exactly a water use, but it's something that's taking up water.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything is just, it's so ephemeral. Everything's always changing.
Yeah. And ephemeral is a really good way of putting it, I think. Everyone has these concrete numbers that they're working off of in terms of how much water they get. It is this sort of like moving target to try and hit. You can measure water, but it's, you can't hold on to it really.
Yeah. And I liked the way that you, sometimes you would look at the beauty of something and say, oh, that was actually man-made because of what they're doing with water, or think about, like, you know, the quote unquote, like, Wild West and like what things were like. But in this instance, it's not, you can learn from the past, but it's not really constructive necessarily to romanticize it or to romanticize that beauty, because it is changing and it's not going to necessarily dictate what's happening next.
It's sort of a hard thing to think about or to like hold in your head, but it was such an interesting one for me, where it's like, I drove into middle of Wyoming and I was like, oh, it's so beautiful and wild. And it turns out that it looks like that because there's been 200, 300 years of irrigation there. And that's why certain places look green, or that's why there's antelope there. Like, the sort of framework of what counts as wild is something I think is super, super interesting, because we have, at this point, we've sort of changed every possible landscape. And so this idea of like returning something back to wild or natural isn't really true in a lot of ways. Like, everything's kind of touched at this point. So I think the question of like, how do we sort of like, as humans, do the best job of managing, maybe not exactly the right word, but like trying to sort of maintain an ecosystem that's already been impacted in all these different ways, is a really, I mean, it's like a really tricky, interesting question.
As a former rafting guide, Heather comes from a recreation background. She fell in love with rivers by spending her summers on them. In the book, she talks to this rafting legend named George Wendt, who unfortunately died of cancer before she was able to ask him her final round of questions. One of them was, how can you use rafting to protect and preserve wild places? I asked Heather whether she asked herself that same question while she was on the trip.
I mean, I think about that all the time in terms of myself, because I think not the only reason, but I think it's really the reason I care about it so much is because I had such a sort of like deep and long personal experience with the river. And I think it's hard. There's so many things to care about. It's like hard to care about things that you don't have any kind of connection to. Even if it's like a weekend or a day or something like that, I think like having a time and a landscape gives you a connection to a place and what's going on and why, in terms of a river, like where the water's going, how it's used, what it looks like. And I think he was a really, really cool guy, but he was like one of the first kind of big commercial raft guides. He started this, what turned into a huge rafting company. And he was really big on the idea of like experience as then an environmental education and a way to sort of spur people to care about issues that might seem really abstract. And I think he kind of like, I mean, he was like a business owner, but he also had this like definite underlying goal of like getting people to care about places. He had had sort of a big, when he was maybe in his 20s, he'd flown to Glen Canyon and had this like life-changing experience there. So he had this really personal tie to it. And then that kind of carried through everything that he did.
Yeah, so that romanticism is beneficial.
Yeah, I think so. And all these people that I talk to, everyone sort of cares about the thing that they're the most personally connected to.
So one thing that you wrote in the book is that conservation means different things depending on who's thinking about it, really. What does conservation mean to you? And like, what does it mean to you living in a city?
It can be hard now to like, because I've talked to so many people who like think about it in smarter, different ways than I do, that to go back to that. But I think my sort of, what I'd always thought of as conservation is just like using less. to me, the idea of conserving was like not using as much as I needed to or using a smaller amount. And then especially right off the bat, I started the trip in kind of central Wyoming, and I started talking to ranchers up there. And the first guy I went and visited, we were talking about this idea of conservation. And he was kind of like, I can't remember exactly how he framed it up, but he was like, when we're using water in the best way that we can, we're using it for multiple uses. And like, you know, I'm irrigating my fields, but then it's also refilling the aquifer, and it's also providing habitat for animals that come through here. And so he had this sort of idea of like, by flooding his fields, he was actually doing the most good for the ecosystem and putting more water back into the system, and then it was going to go downstream. So it was this like conservation in a holistic way that I had never thought about it. And I think like for me, one of the big parts about this trip and this book was kind of like fighting my own biases and my own ideas of like, this is good or this is true or this is how we save the environment. And like realizing that everybody that I was talking to was also, for the most part, was definitely trying to do what they thought was good. They were just coming at it from a totally different place. And then, you know, we're all fighting our own biases about who the good guys and who the bad guys are and who's right.
Yeah, and ultimately, you said communication between the parties is going to be the most important thing, because even, like, I think you went to a town meeting at one point, or this, like, surprise meeting on water, and I can't remember where exactly it was, but everyone was pretty combative until people were able to kind of share their side of the story.
Yeah, that meeting that you're talking about was like a big turning point for me in the whole thing, or it was like this very sort of like concrete example of why it's hard and why the solutions are really hard too. So it was a meeting that the Bureau of Reclamation put on. They have a working group about their dam releases, and they release water for endangered fish because of Endangered Species Act, and they had released more because the reservoir was really full, and then it had flooded out a bunch of farmers' fields, and the fly fishing guides were really pissed off because the river was really high and they couldn't bring customers down. And it was this kind of like anti-government, there's a lot of kind of anti-government, like, those guys in Washington don't care about us, we're trying to make a living sentiment. And, you know, this idea of like, they care about fish more than they care about people. And, you know, I kind of walked into this conference room not knowing what was going to happen, and everyone was just really pissed off, and like, some guys were yelling nasty comments from the back of the room, and this, like, what I thought was going to be a tame, boring government meeting. And eventually the weather forecasters got up and spoke, and then the guys who run the dam got up and spoke, and eventually, once they had kind of said their piece and listened to other people's questions, this sort of like interesting conversation came up about, it was basically a conversation about communication and how people could kind of like talk about their needs and how they wanted more information ahead of time. And by the end of the night, there was a lot of like kind of concrete conversations about like, okay, I get what you're saying. I hear where you're coming from. Can we figure this out? And it felt really productive. And it also felt like something that's really hard to do on a bigger scale. Like, a lot of that was like humans face to face, which I think to me feels like one of those big sort of like future conflict points, where a lot of that is trying to compromise. And I mean, you can say this about like our government right now too, finding compromises by acknowledging the other person's side and not just holding a hard line in stuff that feels really important and like even life or death to people.
You mentioned that the green and your experience there and what's happening there with water rights is, there's different stages throughout the world in terms of water, but it is a bit of a microcosm for like what will happen in certain, you know, we talked about how there's a lot of water in maybe the East Coast, but that with global warming and all the factors that we've been talking about, it will affect other parts of the world as well, and is affecting other parts of the world. What do you think that we can do closer to home? You know, if you're not someone who lives in Colorado or Utah or Wyoming.
Yeah, I think like kind of knowing where your local water comes from and knowing what the issues might be, and also sort of knowing like what the long-term outlook is going to be. Immediate drought and not having enough water is not necessarily the issue that's going to be the most important in terms of resource use or water use everywhere, but I think it's going to happen in a lot of places. maybe sooner than we think. You look at South Africa, or you look at Syria, or there's like sort of places globally where that's becoming an issue. I don't want to overstep my bounds in terms of what I know about climate change.
Yeah, same.
But I feel like that the sort of like things are getting different and more like the, you know, ups and downs of weather and climate are getting bigger. I think it's happening pretty much everywhere, almost everywhere. And so this is like not having enough. Maybe it's not necessarily water. Maybe it's a different resource that you're not going to have enough to go around, or that people are going to be fighting over. And like you need to kind of build in a political and social framework for how to use it equitably. I think that's sort of like going to show up everywhere. You don't want to necessarily push things off until they're desperate in any kind of, you know, resource management, because that's when people get really scared or fights get really serious. So it is sort of like, okay, how can we kind of, humans are notoriously not good at looking to the long-term future, but how can we kind of think about what the potential issues are going to be? Yeah, and I think it is that kind of like, how much risk are people comfortable with, especially in, like when it comes to water, which everybody really needs. Like, how much do you want to over-leverage yourself or over-leverage your community so you get to a point where maybe some people won't be able... I mean, it's already happening in California and in Michigan and places like that where people don't have access to clean water. What does that mean from like an equity point of view?
Reading Downriver made me think a lot about where I live. And it didn't take a lot of research for me to find out what's at risk for rivers, people, and animals in my part of the country. With climate change and storm surges, we're at risk for flooding, drought, contamination of drinking water, species migration, and the loss of ecosystems. We have dams that are susceptible to sea level rising. Just a little digging online, and I found a 60-page strategy document that details it all, as well as outlines what the action plan is for my community. With so much to think about, I'm grateful to Heather for teaching me that these issues are more accessible and less scary than I thought they were. Wrapping up our conversation, I had just one more question for Heather. How does your relationship with water feel now that you've been back for a while?
I did two big river trips, or like, you know, week-long trips this summer, and I feel... Yeah, I feel a little rusty, kind of, or I feel like a little sad that it's not in my life every day. Like, this trip is like definitely one of the coolest things I'm ever going to get to do. And like, that feels really special that I have done that. But I do kind of get that like nostalgia feeling that you're like, oh yeah, that's not really my life anymore. I'm trying to prioritize trips as much as I can, but it's never going to quite be like that. And there's something like a little bittersweet about that.
Yeah, especially when you said it's one of the places you feel most like yourself.
Yeah. Even if I go back, it won't be quite the same. But you also kind of have to be okay with that.
Yeah. Yeah, balance.
Yeah. Like, let the experience be what it is. I don't know. I don't have anything super profound to say about it, but it was really, really cool. To have those places feel like your places, like, there is something really special about that.
Yeah, and to know that as long as they're protected, you have them to return to.
Yeah, which is a tricky, and it's like they probably will change. The whole like preservation versus conservation thing is an interesting one on that front, I think. Even those protected places, they might look really different. If the river's lower, they'll seem different. But yeah, trying to protect them in whatever way makes the most sense. And you can't really know what the future is going to look like, but you kind of have to try to.
Big thank you to Heather for being our first interview of 2019. We'll link her website and where to pre-order Downriver in the show notes and on the episode landing page via she-explores.com. And if you're interested in learning more about water in the West and beyond, we asked Heather to recommend books on the subject, which resulted in 12 essential reads on water conservation. It's on our website and linked in the show notes. Thank you to our sponsor, Ritual. You can get started by heading to ritual.com/explore and show your support for the show. The best way to stay in touch with us is to join our She Explores podcast Facebook group. It's where listeners can connect and chat about episodes, give each other gear and trip advice, and keep the conversation going from episodes. And if you're looking for pre-order info on the She Explores book, you can find it in our show notes, the episode landing page, and in our Facebook group. I'll also be giving away a copy on the She Explores Instagram this week. If you enjoy listening to this show, please take the time to review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It'll help other people find us. Another great way to spread the word is to share the podcast with a friend. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, so if you share it there, make sure to tag us so we'll see it. And recently, I've been listening to Harvard Business Review's podcast, IdeaCast. There's an incredible archive of interviews with business leaders and experts talking about big ideas. If you enjoyed this episode of She Explores, I know you'll enjoy our sister show, Women on the Road. It's all about life on the road from the feminine perspective, hosted by Laura Hughes. Right now it's on hiatus, so you have a few weeks to catch up on all the back archive of episodes, which is pretty fun to do if you're new. We'll be back next week with another episode. Music is by Nihilor, Maiden, and Jason Shaw, using a Creative Commons Attributions license. Until next week, have fun out there.